Not seeing a moderator, I think I will take over some kind of prerogative and just start. I'm Armin Moss, and I'm pleased at this time to share this period with Linda Sillitoe, who's on the podium with me, whose work I have admired for some time. And I haven't met her before just now, and it's a real pleasure to meet her and to share this time with her. We're a little late getting started, so I'd like to charge right along. I have entitled my presentation, The Fading of the Pharaoh's Curse, which is, in a word, the treatment of the rise and fall of the traditional LDS ban against priesthood holding by blacks. This treatment is a condensation of a much longer paper, and I'm going to do my best to condense it. As I was explaining to Linda, unaccustomed as I am to brevity, I'm not sure how this is going to work out. I will do my best to leave her an appreciable hunk of time. I don't have a copy of the paper except for this long version, manuscript version, which Peggy assures me is going to be published in Sunstone in some early upcoming issues. It's so long that it's going to have to be serialized. She's going to do it in two installments. So those of you who are interested in having a copy of it, I will ask you to wait till it comes out in Sunstone. And that means any of you who aren't subscribers should really get subscriptions right away for that. Now that the commercial has been given, I'm particularly pleased that this presentation follows on the heels of the one Tom just gave, because in a way it raises some of the same questions about the meaning and place of Revelation in the LDS Church. In particular, the following questions about theoretical questions about Revelation have occurred to me as I've been studying this subject, and I'm sure they've occurred to most of you too. One question is, what is the difference, if there is any, between revealed doctrine on the one hand and administrative policy on the other? Do these two things have a different status of some kind? Are they acquired and legitimated differently? The second question is, and it was implicit in a lot of what Tom said and then made explicit in, I think, Alan's question at the end, and that question is, what exactly constitutes revelation, revealed doctrine, or revelation in the church, and what are the variety of modes of acquiring revelation or getting revelation? And it appears to me that you can arrange all of this on a scale. We're used to using scales of 1 to 10. So envision with me, if you can, a scale of 1 to 10, which might be called a scale of revelational modes or a scale of theophany or something. And at the lower extreme of the scale would be, in my mind, things like talks that general authorities, especially apostles, come and give in state conferences. And one of the questions one can ask is, if an apostle says something at a state conference, is that revelation? I'm assuming here now something that isn't already found in the scriptures. If he says it, is it revelation? Well, if it is, it rates about a 1. In my way of looking at this. Now, a 10 at the other extreme of this hypothetical scale would be the kind of thing that we see in the prophet Joseph's first vision or in the visit of Moroni, where you actually get a visit of a heavenly being and he tells you something. Any who, to borrow some of the terminology from the Word of Wisdom, any who are or aspire to be called saints cannot very well gainsay anything that is represented as having come in that number 10 fashion. Along that scale is a whole variety of other modes that I think one could perhaps, with a little effort, theoretically rank order in terms of the extent to which they are binding or incumbent upon the members of the church. Included in there would, for example, be talks in general conference. They rank up there somewhere, maybe beyond five. I'm not sure just where beyond five. There are articles in the Ensign, or what used to be the Improvement Era. There are directives that come to priesthood leaders from time to time. All of these things are authoritative, and we have a sense that all of them have to be listened to and paid attention to, but it's always been kind of ambiguous just how binding they are, upon whom, for what purposes. And that is a question that I think has never been as salient and, in fact, excruciating a question as when it's applied to the issue of the priesthood ban against blacks. And then a third kind of interesting theoretical issue that occurs to me here is this. Referring back to this scale of 1 to 10 again, if we get something, some innovation in the doctrines or policies of the church at one point on this scale, does it have to be changed by something at a comparable point or something higher on the scale, or can it be changed by something lower on the scale? In other words, is there a kind of symmetry here between the level of incumbency upon us at which a certain policy is received and that level at which it is revoked or changed or modified? Now, we have all these problems in the LDS Church really only because of our commitment to a very fundamental theological notion of continuing revelation. And if we didn't have that notion, life would be a lot simpler, wouldn't it? When there's a commitment to that principle, why, then a whole lot of sticky things come up that wouldn't if you didn't accept in the first place the idea of a living mouthpiece of God, a living prophet. If you didn't accept that idea in the first place, then you could have a variety of authoritative and wise people at the top of a religion that could endlessly interpret and reinterpret and reapply previous dogma to contemporary situations, which I think is the mode that is generally accepted in the Christian world. But when you make so bold as to say that the mouthpiece, or that the president of the church is the mouthpiece of God, and when you thereby in effect empower that president of the church to receive revelations that may be at 180 degree odds from earlier revelations, why, you get into some of these theoretical questions that I raised. So I think there is some interest to all of that. I think it's safe to say that for Mormons, the black issue before this revelation in June of 78, that the black issue had become the most embarrassing public relations problem since the polygamy issue of the late 19th century. In order to understand why official Mormon policy remained at odds with the prevailing zeitgeist for so long, it is necessary to understand first, I think, certain internal matters of Mormon ecclesiastical governance and theology. A church policy of withholding the priesthood from blacks came early on to be defined as a matter that could be changed only by the prophet in response to a new revelation from God. Though there would seem to be some historical question about that definition of the nature of the policy, it was so defined by the leaders of the church. As a result, there was no way in which one could raise questions about the legitimacy of that policy without also questioning the integrity and charisma of the office of prophet. This point was not sufficiently clear to the critics of this policy, within or without the church, I think. When they began to clamor in the 1960s for a change in the policy discriminating against Mormon blacks, they were insufficiently sensitive to the damage that could be done to the integrity of the office of the prophet by any intimations that he could receive a revelation on demand, as it were, in response to external political pressure. Cynics had already made such a charge in the 1890s when the practice of polygamy was suddenly stopped by prophetic decree after decades of federal harassment. And the same snide tone, indeed, still characterized much of the media commentary when the new revelation opening the priesthood to blacks was finally given in 1978. For such a revelation, however, as that one that came in 78, to have been announced in the late 1960s, right at the height of the political agitation for it, would have left very little room for anything but a cynical interpretation of how the prophetic office is conducted. Such a development for most Mormons was to be avoided, even at the cost of continuing denial of the priesthood to blacks and any concomitant embarrassment therefrom. I think it would be safe to say that this was the prevailing sentiment, even among practicing Mormons, most in favor of a change in the church policy. That is, the integrity of the office of the prophet was more important even than racial equality or societal respectability. Change would have to come in the prophet's own due time, not at the demand of pickets around Temple Square. In other words, there was to be no reenactment in Mormon vestments of the assault of aggiornamento upon the papacy. Now, when I'm going to be partly reading and partly summarizing here to try to fit in to another 15 or 20 minutes time, when the revelation came in June of 78, ending this ban against priesthood holding by blacks, there was a widespread sense, I think, that it was sort of a bolt out of the blue, that all of a sudden we're going along here and sort of living with this policy, and all of a sudden, boom, a big change comes. I think a little retrospection over history, especially recent history, will show that this was not the case at all, that there is very definitely a systematic, one almost would say calculated, leading up to the revelation of June of 78 as an explicit church policy. I'm going to assume that people in this audience know what the policy was that prevailed until June of 78, and I'm going to assume also that you all know what some of the theological official and unofficial theological backdrop was that was used in support of this policy. And so I will skip over that. But I would like to point out this. In all of the theologizing in support of denial of the priesthood to blacks, there were only two elements that ever had any official canonical status in the church that I can see. One was there is in the church, a doctrine about preexistence, where there is a war in heaven, but even that doctrine is not anywhere in the scriptures applied to the question of differential merit expressed in different racial lineages in mortality, only that there was a preexistence in which different individuals may have been foreordained for special callings. Then the other canonical element was the reference to the line of the pharaohs and the ineligibility of that line for the priesthood. But that reference to the pharaohs in the book of Abraham, which was not, as you know, itself canonized until 1879 or 80, that reference to the pharaohs in no way identifies that lineage of the pharaohs with modern Africans or their descendants. There's something else that can be said about the book of Moses. I won't go into it now. A lot of this consideration of what's doctrine and what's folklore I considered years ago in my 1967 dialogue article, and I would rather not repeat it here, but I think if a careful reading of the book of Moses would show that the references there to a cursed lineage come, first of all, many generations after Cain, whose lineage is the one that's supposed to have been cursed, and furthermore, that the comments that occur in chapters 5, 6, and 7 of the book of Moses. I can't remember now which book of Moses. Some of you can tell me, 2 or 5, anyway. those references in the book of Moses to a cursed lineage that was descended from Cain and to a cursed people in Canaan are all parts of a vision which Enoch is having about some future time. And so I insist, therefore, in light of what I have just said, that there was never was an appreciable scriptural basis in the church for denial of the priesthood to anybody by racial lineage. And there had to be developed a theological structure for that purpose. Now, there has already been a fair amount of historical work on this subject, and again, I'm going to assume that most of you know about that. Besides the earlier article of my own that I mentioned, which is not primarily historical, there are the two important articles by Lester Bush in different dialogue issues in the recent past. There is also the book by Stephen Taggart before that. Then there is a whole lot of recent work being done by Newell Bringhurst, another young historian. And all of those works taken together, I think, give a pretty thorough picture of the historical process by which the church came to have this policy denying the priesthood to blacks. Not all of these scholars whom I've just mentioned necessarily agree with each other, I hasten to add. I would also like to mention the work of Ron Esplin, whose work is very recent and is quite at odds with the theoretical interpretations of the other people I mentioned. But my own reading of their work and of other historical work convinces me that the policy was not initiated by the prophet Joseph Smith, and that it is a product of the period since the migration to Utah, and a product in large part in the beginning of the enterprise of Brigham Young himself. I think it's possible to divide that period from, if you will, 1830 down to 1978 into five different stages. And in my more extended paper, I have something to say about what happened in each of these five stages of history. The first couple stages from 1830 to 1846, and then from second one from 1846 to 1880, I think it was, were both stages in which there was a kind of an accumulation of intimations of one kind or another about the status of the black man in the church, at least in the first of these two periods. And then in the second of these two periods after Brigham Young, we begin to see a kind of concentrated and systematic buildup of, first of all, a policy of denying priesthood privileges to people of that ancestry, and second of all, a kind of theological buildup to support that denial. Now, rather than go over all of that territory with you, since others have done it already and done it better than I would just like to say that the only thing in my treatment that I have added, I think, to what the others have done has been to try to emphasize the external national American influences on the church during these periods, as well as the internal developments. For example, I think in the first of these periods, when the prophet Joseph was heading the church, there was quite a lot of ambivalence about the role and status of black people in the church. The attitude seemed to shift somewhat from one location to the other, depending on whether they were in Missouri or north of there, and that I think one can see here that a great deal of not only ambivalence, but an attempt to deal with the question of blacks in the church on pretty much an ad hoc basis. Whenever an issue came up, One has a sense that the brethren tried to confront it and deal with it on that kind of ad hoc basis rather than having an overall general policy about it. And to some extent, one has the impression that some of the brethren were rushing around trying to put out brush fires that were started by others of the brethren during this period over that issue, especially in the Missouri period. Then after the move to Utah, when we begin to see, I think for the first time, a definite church policy on this subject, I don't think that policy can be understood strictly as an expression of some unique racism on the part of Brigham Young and his colleagues. I think if you read what Brigham Young had to say about black people, and you read what, for that matter, Abraham Lincoln had to say about it before he became president of the United States, and you read what other people of that period had to say about it, Brigham Young's ideas about black people were not very different from those of other people of the same time, even other northern people. And I think it's a great oversimplification to say, well, Brother Brigham was a racist, and that's how we got all this. He was not any more of a racist than Abraham Lincoln. If you take some of Abraham Lincoln's remarks in the 1850s, as late as the 1850s, about what he thought of the black man's position in the eyes of God, I have some of this documented here. I think it's also important to recognize that the federal government was not greatly loved by the people of Utah during this period, and grew less loved by the people of Utah as time went on. Surely the cause of the Union in the struggle between North and South could not have had a great deal of support from Utah. I don't know of any evidence that Utah ever helped the Confederate cause. I see there's a new book out on Utah during the Civil War, Mormons during the Civil War. I haven't read it yet. There may be something in there that I'd find enlightening. But as I say, while I don't know of any evidence that the Confederate cause was ever helped by anybody in Utah during this time, it's very clear that Utah did not wish the Union cause particularly well. And Brigham Young, in fact, flatly predicted, as I'm sure many of you know, that the North could not win the Civil War, that the South would prevail and all of that, and that it was God's will that the Southern definition of blacks should be the definition that would prevail. When you see a growing trend in the nation at large to condemn polygamy and slavery in the same breath, which became more and more commonly done, until in the, as I'm sure you know, in the 1856 platform of the New Republican Party, these two twin relics of barbarism were condemned together. It's not difficult to see, it seems to me, that in Utah you could find the development of a kind of sense of common predicament with the South, and a tendency to resist incursions of the North, and to sympathize somewhat maybe more with what was going on in the South. And in fact, slavery of both blacks and Indians was permitted in Utah for a period during these very years. Later period, after 1880, we have, and after Reconstruction, we have the rise of what have since come to be known as the Jim Crow laws. And I think if you'll look at that period from about 1880 to World War I, which was the period of the Progressive Movement, but also was the period of the end to Reconstruction and the re-ensconcement of Negroes in their place, as it were, the rise of, as I say, of the Jim Crow laws. All of that took place in Utah, just as it did everywhere else, and it was not any unique development in Utah. There was a general national reaction against equality for blacks in that period. It's very well documented in Van Woodward's book called The Strange Career of Jim Crow. And it was the significant thing about the period between the Civil War and World War I, I think, was that there was a growing systematizing and codifying of the ideas about blacks that had been espoused by a number of church leaders prior to that time. And eventually, the theological superstructure, or substructure, for the church policy about blacks was codified, I think, in its most distilled and final form in Joseph Fielding Smith's Way to Perfection, which I think was first published in 1931. Okay, what's more interesting than all of this, though, I think, is what happened after all that. While I think it's possible to show that this theological and quasi-theological substructure was gradually built up from the time of Brigham Young on, you reach a certain apex of that, and then you begin to see a gradual dismantling of it. And it's the dismantling of it that I think is by far the more interesting subject. If you'll skip over a lot of history with me for a moment to the period after World War II. From World War I to World War II, there wasn't a whole lot noticeably done about the black issue or about too many other things. It was the time, you'll all recall, of normalcy with Prohibition. But where blacks were concerned, after all, I think we have to understand that much of the disinclination of Mormons to quote-unquote do anything about blacks arises from the fact that, first of all, there weren't very many in the church, and second of all, Mormons by and large didn't see very many. And I'm intrigued by the fact that as late as 1957, when Thomas O'Day first produced his distinguished anthropological work called The Mormons, at the end of this book, he lays out a series of what he calls strains and conflicts in Mormonism, and he doesn't even mention the race issue. Just doesn't even mention it in 1957. And I don't think that's because O'Day was careless. I think it's because as late as 1957, nobody else noticed it either, to speak of. It wasn't until we had the convergence of two important developments that we began to get a so-called Mormon race problem. And these two developments were the mushrooming growth in the church and its increasing encounter with the world outside of the mountains, on the one hand, and the great rise of the civil rights movement in the United States. So these two things came together in the 1960s. And so thereafter we had a race problem, quote unquote, and we didn't really have one before that. During the period of the 1950s and 60s, there were a number of attempts made by the leaders of the church to deal with outside criticism about this. The outside criticism did not come in any sustained way until the early 60s. There were a couple of barbs from LDS or former LDS scholars, which the First Presidency responded to. Some of you know about the letters of Lowry Nelson, first of all to the First Presidency, and then eventually published in The Nation magazine, and their responses there too. Those were in the late 40s and early 50s. 1951, I think, is the very first time that the First Presidency ever issued a general proclamation on the subject. And that general proclamation in 1951 pretty much took the position that would be in harmony with Joseph Fielding Smith's treatment in Way to Perfection, or a kind of plagiarism, in effect, of that Bruce McConkie has in Mormon Doctrine. Up through that point, in the 50s and at the dawn of the 60s, we have the leaders of the church strongly, confidently taking the position that it's always been the policy of the church that blacks cannot receive the priesthood. We're not apologizing for it. We just know that that's the Lord's will. And that 1951 letter cited some of the reasons why it might have been the Lord's will. Reference was made to pre-existence, to cursed lineages, and so on. And there was no embarrassment about that. In a way, it was kind of a surprise, I think, to the leaders of the church and to all the rest of us, because Mormons are not accustomed to being considered the offenders in matters of civil rights. We're usually the victims. When all of a sudden, why the heat of the nation is turned on us for being the offenders, it was kind of a surprise. And I think that was the general stance of the church, a kind of "who, us?" sort of reaction, never really a sense that we had a major issue here. Well, beginning in the 1960s, we begin to get both a more sustained criticism of the church for this and a more sustained effort at rebuttal. And that part is, I think, the most interesting. There were official statements issued in 1963 and again in 1965, both of which, in effect, supported the civil rights movement of the nation, while insisting on the right of Mormons to have this peculiar policy inside the church about blacks, still enjoining Mormons in their dealings with blacks outside the church to act out all of the principles and imperatives, really, of the civil rights movement, of equal access to gainful employment and educational opportunity and to all privileges of citizenship. And the assertion in the 65 statement that there is in this church no doctrine, belief, or practice that is intended to deny the enjoyment of full civil rights by any person, regardless of race, color, or creed. This 65 statement had avoided mentioning, let alone justifying, the church priesthood policy per se. It simply upheld the emerging civil rights doctrine of the nation. If that statement had been issued in the hope of stemming further criticism of the church, the hope was surely in vain, for the criticism actually mounted during the remainder of the 60s, both from outside the church and from within. Then we have a series of reactions from the presiding brethren after that to things that came along. The next thing was in late 1969, for the first presidency, Elder Brown and Elder Tanner issued a statement. President McKay was pretty well incapacitated by then and only a few weeks from his death. But in there we had the top leadership of the church in late 69 issued another statement. This statement reiterated the Mormon commitment to secular civil rights and again claimed the right of the church under the First Amendment to make internal ecclesiastical policy on the priesthood without external interference. But this time the statement went further. And for the first time in two decades, this First Presidency statement offered a theological explanation for denying blacks the priesthood. This explanation this time is remarkable for its parsimony. While referring back vaguely to a premortal life, the 1969 statement says nothing about that life, nothing about the war in heaven, or about any differential merit having implications for mortality. It says nothing about Cain or Ham or marks or curses or perpetual servitude. It relies almost entirely on the simple claim that the church has barred Negroes from the priesthood since its earliest days, quote, "for reasons which we believe are known to God, but which he has made not made fully known to man," unquote. Thus, in its first official statement on the controversy in nearly a generation, the church effectively jettisoned almost the entire mythological baggage that had been used for a century as the basis for its priesthood policy toward blacks. The policy itself was to remain, however, for nearly another decade, and the church seemed exasperatingly impervious to outside pressure, whether in the form of pickets, politics, or bad press. And as you know, during this time, there was a campaign mounted against BYU for a while, and the athletic relationships were broken off. President Wilkinson's full-page ad that came out in papers, the newspapers at that time, I thought was a very nice piece of public relations work. It spoke very well to the issues. It didn't help a whole lot, though, and about the only thing I think that broke off the pressure against BYU was the coming of summer, and student movements very seldom carry over from one side of the summer to the next. Let us review, then, what some of the significant changes were in Mormon views on racial matters up to this time. We have already seen that the 1969 official statement omitted nearly all of the mythological basis for the priesthood policy, as indeed President McKay's own private letter of 1947 had done, that his son Llewellyn published. Less well publicized, but still noticed by Time magazine, was the abortive 1963 effort to open a Mormon mission to Nigeria, a total reversal of the policy theretofore of de-emphasizing or avoiding the proselyting of blacks. The new Nigerian mission was aborted in the last minutes when Nigerian authorities suddenly became aware of the Mormon policy on blacks and refused visas to the missionaries. But the very decision to open the mission was a significant departure from earlier policy. I think you know that in September of 78, a new one was opened when the Cannons and the Mabees went over and opened it. During the same general period, the church greatly expanded its missionary activities among other dark-skinned peoples in Polynesia, Melanesia, and Latin America. Scarcely known at all, even to church members, were several other ad hoc flexibilities that were introduced into applications of the church Negro policy during President McKay's administration. Examples of these were ordinations of some men of probable but not definite Negro ancestry, and an explicit exclusion of any other dark races from the ban against blacks. The general policy implications that emerged from these decisions by President McKay were, one, that a specific lineage, not color per se, was the salient criterion. Number two, that even in cases of questionable lineage, the burden of proof was upon the church to establish ineligibility for the priesthood, no longer upon the member to clear himself. In any case, as the church entered the new decade of the 1970s, it was still holding to its traditional ban against blacks in the priesthood, but that ban had been reduced to its bare-bones form, with virtually none of the traditional mythology left to support it, and it was being given as liberal an interpretation as possible within the church. In the surrounding society, meanwhile, the civil rights movement had begun to peak. A less supportive national government had come to power. Many of the movement's objectives for blacks had been accomplished, and other minorities of both ethnic and other sorts were now laying claim to some of the same attention and amelioration that blacks had won for themselves. Accordingly, Mormons were granted a respite for most of the 1970s, but with little more national attention being directed toward their unfashionable but apparently unalterable ecclesiastical residue of racism. The outstanding developments of the 1970s with respect to the issue at hand were the respite granted the church over the issue by its critics, black and white, in the civil rights movement, the reconciliation between the church and the blacks, in particular, and the revelation late in that decade, which finally ended a century or more of a policy barring blacks from the priesthood. After about 1970, the civil rights advocates and other critics of the Mormon policy backed off noticeably. It was as though they had all decided to give up on the obstinate Mormons and to look to other perceived violations of the national equalitarian ethos. The campaign against BYU did not survive the summer of 70, as I've indicated. The Mormon Church, for its part, began to show a great deal more awareness and sensitivity about race relations generally and relations with blacks in particular. At the death of President McKay in January 1970, his position as prophet and president was assumed by Joseph Fielding Smith, well known in the church as a rather stern conservative and as the chief codifier and advocate of the traditional racial mythology that had by then largely been dismantled by Presidents McKay and Brown. In spite of considerable speculation about a presumably reactionary stance that President Smith would take on the black issue, no such development materialized. He never reiterated the ideas he had expressed as a younger man, and indeed he presided over the creation of the first organized black group within the Mormon Church, the Genesis Group, of which more was to be said later, but I probably won't have time. He thereby earned the notice and approval of one of the more vociferous critics of the church from the 1960s, a couple of New York columnists. In 1974, the church inadvertently ran afoul of the Boy Scouts of America through a new organizational arrangement that had the effect of integrating its scout troops closely with its junior priesthood groups. The church and the Boy Scouts had earlier agreed on this change, but neither had anticipated that the resultant barring of black boys from positions of scout leadership in Mormon troops. Actually, all non-Mormons in those troops would also have been barred because of not holding the priesthood. When the issue was raised in the case of a particular black Utah youngster, the church's response and corrective action were very fast in coming. The church clearly was more responsive now. At the same time, however, it was as insistent as ever that the policy change relating to the priesthood itself would still have to come through legitimate channels, and it tolerated but little dissent from the inside over this issue. Insiders, after all, should know better. And this, I think it's in that context we got two kind of celebrated excommunications of men, Wallace in Oregon, and Marchant, who had, as far as I can tell, theretofore been fairly loyal members of the church. Toward the outside, though, there seemed to be an increasingly conciliatory posture on racial matters. It was as though, with the pressure off, the church could afford to be less defensive about the integrity of its procedures for legitimate change. Nowhere was this new relaxed posture more evident than in Mormon relationships with blacks during the 70s. In retrospect, it seems clear that the church at the beginning of the decade launched a deliberate and sustained campaign to build bridges with blacks, both inside and outside the church. If the church was not yet ready to bestow the priesthood on blacks, it at least felt the need to come to know more blacks better and to remove the aura of the forbidden that had accumulated around blacks in the mythology and consciousness of most white Mormons. It is scarcely possible for outsiders to appreciate the fundamental significance of this development, however gradually it may have occurred. It was indeed, I think, second in significance only to the bestowal of the priesthood itself, that is, this bridge building with blacks. Now I go off and I give a lot of examples about this. We have BYU giving scholarships to blacks. We have a BYU student body vice president that was elected who was black. We have Alex Haley coming to talk to BYU. We have Senator Brooke coming to talk to BYU. We have all kinds of publicity being given to black Tabernacle Choir members, to that black sister in Washington, D.C. that had been doing temple work of a non-priesthood required kind before the priesthood was actually given to blacks. I did a little tally in the Church News index. The index to the Church News for the period 1961 to 1970 shows only one listing on the topic of Negroes. But thereafter, there are several listings every year. So the Church News began to pay a lot more attention. Then the organization of the Genesis Group, I think, was very significant, and I'm sorry I don't have time to say more about that. It'll be in the published version. But I think the symbolic significance of the Genesis Group was far more important than its substantive significance. It went a long way, I think, to strengthen the identity of black Mormons. Let me sum this much up then by saying, as of mid-1978, the Mormon mythology and priesthood policy regarding blacks, which had taken root during Brigham Young's day and had been crystallized and codified during two generations following, began gradually to be transformed in the generation following World War II. The first thing to change was the connection between the ecclesiastical definitions about blacks and their civic social roles. The Civil War ended slavery for Utah as well as for the South. As the Civil Rights Movement, with its derivative legal developments, made racial discrimination increasingly untenable for Mormons as for others, the Mormon leadership unequivocally embraced the civil rights ideals of the late 1960s and 70s. The next thing to go was the theological folklore about Cain, Ham, and their descendants. A little slower in going was the reference to a premortal life as the explanation for the priesthood ban. This disappeared in stages, starting with the tide of the war in heaven, leaving only vague references to a differential premortal merit, which also finally disappeared in the 1970s. The total dismantling of the entire theological mythology that had built up over the years was signaled by an official statement from the church's public relations director in April 1978. He was quoted in the press as saying, "Any reason given for the priesthood ban, except that it comes from God, is pure supposition and not doctrine." That's about as parsimonious a theological statement as you can get. Now, the final step in the progress toward eventual dropping of the priesthood ban was the deliberate redefinition of the black as an acceptable and desirable associate and equal. To some extent, of course, this goal had been a major thrust of the national civil rights movement, which had had its impact upon Mormons as well as upon others through various civil and secular media. For Mormons, though, in the final analysis, the most salient medium was their religion, particularly the approval or disapproval of their church leaders. As long as the black man appeared to be regarded by church leaders as persona non grata, or even as the invisible man, Mormons could be expected to keep their distance from blacks, even while formally accepting and acting out an equalitarian stance toward them. The campaign during the 1970s by the Mormon leadership to redefine blacks seems in retrospect to have been an essential, if belated, effort at helping to prepare the membership of the church for the sudden and dramatic revelation of June 1978, which removed the ban on blacks altogether. With the mythological substructure removed and a new visibility and identity being created for blacks in the Mormon milieu, the stage was set for the revelation that ultimately removed totally the ban against blacks in the priesthood, and with it the last remnants of officially sanctioned racial discrimination in Mormon culture. Then I go on to say that what I think we had here was an interesting case where on this scale of revelation from 1 to 10 that I talked about, it's difficult to figure out where, from that scale, we got the ban against blacks on the priesthood, the ban against blacks with respect to the priesthood. But we got a revelation changing that ban, eliminating that ban, that came very close to the end of the scale. It wasn't a 10 because nobody claimed that a messenger from heaven came, but it was certainly at least a 9. And when you read the account in the Church News that President Kimball gave, and you read a talk that I've quoted from extensively that Elder McConkie gave in August of 78 down at BYU to the Seminary Institute teachers, it's very clear that that whole procedure whereby the change came and the new revelation came was defined by the presiding brethren as a dramatic development, one in which the Lord did indeed personally intervene. President Kimball, in fact, goes on to say that this revelation came to him in spite of lifelong feelings that he'd had that blacks should not be given the priesthood. And so it was all defined as a very important development. So here we have a case where a ban of a racial kind was maybe not received by revelation, at least not by any recorded revelation, but it was certainly changed by revelation. And I think there's an interesting parallel there with the issue all through the New Testament over whether or not Gentiles had to be circumcised before they could be baptized. This was clearly a case where a racial distinction was being made between converts of one ethnic group versus another ethnic group. And it seems clear to me, I've got a whole lot of references here from the New Testament about controversies that Paul had with Peter over this. Peter should have known better because he got a revelation about it kind of late. And he seems to have been late to act out the implications of his revelation of the vision of the unclean meat. And it looks as though that Peter had a lot of wavering on this. And when he was with James and John, who seemed to be kind of hardcore Judaizers, why he sort of went along with them. And then when Paul came back and said, you know, what's this I hear? I go to Greece and I come back and all these people are telling me when I get to Greece that they're not going to join the church because we're going to have to circumcise them first. And Peter says, well, that isn't really right. And Paul says, well, that's what I hear everywhere I go. I'm making this dialogue up, of course. But you have that sense, I think, from reading the back and forth between Paul and the others in the New Testament. Well, eventually, this change was made, I think we're to understand, by revelation to Peter. And even though there had not been, as far as we can tell, any revelation instituting the ban, or not the ban, instituting the requirement that Gentiles had to be circumcised, that had to be changed by revelation. And I think that's an interesting parallel. Now, I've pretty well exhausted the time, but I think you'll all sympathize with the fact that we didn't get started until 15 minutes into the time we were supposed to have. I think, though there's a lot more that could be said, I will end here, and I won't bear my testimony, but I will say that I think we have here a very interesting case study in what revelation is and under what circumstances revelation is required. I think it was extremely important that the revelation changing the status of blacks in the church came so high on the scale at a 9. If it had been any lower down the scale, there would have been a lot of room left for controversy. As it is, there have been some people who've objected to it, but generally, around the church, it appears to me that the June 78 revelation has been accepted with a fair amount of equanimity and not a whole lot of opposition. I think there would have been a lot more if anding and butting and about it, and a lot more kind of hemming and hawing and wondering and dragging of the feet if the change in this had been made at a lower level on this scale. But since it was made at such a high level, where the president of the church says, the Lord told me that there was time to make this change, and all the apostles said, yeah, I was there and he told me too. When that happens, it's very difficult for a member of the church to say, well, gee, I don't know. You may be able to say, well, gee, I don't know, when it comes to the question of how we got that priesthood ban in the first place, but it's pretty hard to say that there was anything but a legitimate revelation ending it. And I think that was a very important development and has gone a long way to silence what might otherwise have been quite a lot of controversy in the church about it. Thank you for your time, and I hope you'll give Linda 10 or 15 minutes for her comments.
My secret reason for agreeing to do things for Sunstone is so I can see how they'll describe me, either in the magazine or today on the program. When I began publishing poems now and then, I found it very difficult to come up with a line or two about who I was and what I do, since I don't have all the academic and other qualifications that some other contributors do. And after the first year or two, I gave it up, and I started just waiting to see what they would write about me. My favorite all-time one did appear in Sunstone, where it said that I am the author of several investigative poems. Today, I'm described as a freelance writer, with an emphasis on the free, and a poetess. And with all due respect to Eliza R. Snow, I must admit that I regard poetess as a term similar in stature to historiette. Nevertheless, I'm glad that poetry was mentioned, because just before coming in here, one friend asked me very tactfully and nicely why I'm appearing as a respondent on this subject, which I think is a very logical question. And if I'm qualified at all, I'm qualified as a poet. I think that all of us remember what we were doing on June 9th, 1978. I remember talking on the telephone a lot. And one of the friends I talked with said to me, well, gee, you must be feeling pretty good today. And I said, yeah, I'm feeling terrific, but why do you say that? And she said, well, you predicted this would happen, don't you remember? And I had predicted it, and it seemed so obvious to me that President Kimball would give the priesthood to blacks, to black men. You have to get the language straight here. Only the Gentile men were circumcised, too, at least as far as I know. They may not have. And I had read the historical research on the subject. I'd been a part of many long discussions on the topic, as I'm sure most of you were, and I believed that the policy was wrong and that it would change. And after reading the Kimball biography and taking a long, hard look at the line of succession among the brethren, I decided that President Kimball would offer the priesthood to black men. I found, however, after confiding in some people close to me, that I'd do better to keep my prediction secret. Despite the preparation of the membership, most of them thought that I was very optimistic, to say the least. I think that this paper by Armand Moss is an important contribution, and I hope that all of you will read it in Sunstone. I've had the opportunity to read that longer version, and although I didn't know exactly which parts would be used today, I'm glad that I had that chance. It skims over the years, over the history and the events and the statements, and takes note of the trends and the patterns that brought this about without becoming bogged down in detail in any particular time. And even so, as he mentioned, it's quite long. I think it's important to piece that mosaic together, because all of us in some way have been a part of it. It was humbling to remember how tardy our consciousness of inequality among the races was as Americans and as Mormons. I also found myself angry at times at the continuation of that obvious injustice, of the institutionalization of the injustice, and of the justification that we make for both. Imagine for a minute that there's a platform resting in the air, floating with nothing suspending it. The platform is this. The Lord says the blacks cannot hold the priesthood. Then, as is described in the paper, supporting pillars are added beneath the platform so that they seem to hold it up. Marks and curses, less than valiant, the war in heaven, and so on. Gradually, over a period of years, the pillars are slowly removed one by one. So gradually, in fact, that most of the membership who seemed to like those pillars, since they supported many of their own feelings about the races, didn't even notice that they were gone. And yet still the platform floats in the air, needing only the word of the Lord to change what is said to be the will of the Lord. By observing that platform, we can see how ecclesiastical tradition, to use Armon Moss's phrase, is constructed and how it can be dismantled. At the crux of the matter, I think that this can assist us not only in understanding our immediate past, but perhaps it may be instructive for the future. A group of individuals, in short, are born to bodies which, because of their type, are deemed unfit for the priesthood of God. And then reasons, explanations, and complacencies are added to support that dictum, which in fact floats by itself. Slowly the supporting myths may be removed so that the platform itself may come down. This image illustrates an interesting conflict in this paper, that of the sanctity of the office of the prophet, which is, we are told, more important in itself than rectifying an error, as was done in microcosm in the case of the Boy Scout troop, when that problem was quickly changed and very effectively changed. And yet the platform in the air is not blacks cannot hold the priesthood, but the Lord says blacks cannot hold the priesthood. Even that final statement, given in April, only months before the revelation itself by a church PR man, which read, "Any reason for the black policy, except that it comes from God, is supposition, not doctrine," is hailed as being the bare bones of the policy. It is the bare bones, but those bones, for me at least, are as heavy as clubs. When we talk about preparing the membership, it seems cynical to even ask, and yet I wonder, are we saying that the brethren knew that the policy was wrong, but waited while they prepared us? I don't think so. I think that that would be as dishonest as a revelation on demand would be. This paper and others have brought to light persuasive evidence that this policy was man-made. Man-made by Brigham Young with help from Joseph F. Smith, Joseph Fielding Smith, and later Bruce R. McConkie. I agree with that. And yet all of those men were or are sustained as prophets, seers, and revelators. And they evidently believed and they told us that the policy was the Lord's will. In between telephone calls on June 9th, I sat down in my living room and I read those passages that I had so often heard in Sunday school and at firesides that said, "Black men will never hold the priesthood in this life." That wasn't in a book called My Opinions by a man with limited knowledge who was delighted to change his opinion. It was in a book called Mormon Doctrine. And so the question is still in my mind that has been there ever since June 9th. And that's not a question for historians to answer, but for the church leaders to answer. There used to be a platform floating in the air. What is the church's reason why it was there? Why was it ever there? Because if those reasons are not forthcoming, the offspring of the myths will return to support what was. There has to be a kind of continuity. I agree that the issue of revelation is very important to this issue. President McKay, it is noted in a footnote in this paper, came close, perhaps, to changing this policy as a matter of policy. That might have been possible for him. For President Kimball, it was a matter requiring much asking, much knocking at the door, much wrestling with his own feelings and teachings, as well as with new information. We might look for just a minute at some of the words that we're using, such as prophet. When I was growing up, and President McKay was president, he was President McKay. Once in a while, our primary or Sunday school teachers reminded us that he was a prophet, and those were in hushed moments. But he wasn't the prophet in common, ordinary speech. That was Joseph Smith. Now the prophet is the current prophet, the living prophet. Priesthood used to be the creative force that blesses and creates. Now it is the men who hold that power, as in, will the priesthood please administer the sacrament, or we thank the priesthood for supporting us in the welfare assignment. Another word that I think is interesting in this paper is revelation. Revelation, it seems to me, used to come more rarely and was of a number 9 or 10 nature all the time. And yet, President Kimball told AP reporters in the summer of 78 in a rather exclusive interview that he receives revelations continually. And the word seems to be in current usage, both for him and for us, more what inspiration used to be, more the 1, 2, 3 and so on communication from God. In conclusion, let me set just one more image out beside that floating platform. True ideas are traditionally represented by light. Let's imagine that each of us have in the porthole of our minds a candle. Mormon doctrine insists that light may come to anyone. Your candle or mine may be lighted individually. It seems logical that candles may be lit throughout the membership before enough energy is created to light the candles high on the tower, which once lit kindle all the other candles. That's what I call preparing the membership. And yet let us consider the peril of the individual with a candle that is lighted early. She cannot run through the streets exhibiting her lighted candle, precious though it may be. He must be cautious not to set his lighted candle where it will be contrasted to a higher unlit candle. And yet the candles must burn on hope and faith, giving light unto all that are in the house. This paper reminded me that in the midst of my joy at seeing change accomplished, there is still pain. We have seen some of the ways in which change may occur. I think that we must rejoice not only for our brothers, those who have received and those who have given, but let us remember those who did not live long enough to receive what was rightfully theirs, and for those who could not live patiently enough. Let's take note of the urgency and the recalcitrance of change, not only for the past, but for the future. Thank you.
Oh, you're here. You don't have time for this. I know, I'm not going to get it this time.